The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
So, good evening, everyone. It's nice to be with you tonight. Nice to have some old friends with us here we don't often get to see, as well as some new people. Also some new people online. So welcome to our monthly atonement ceremony, Fusatsu. We do it once a month. It's a chance to reflect on our ethical conduct and the precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts. And I won't go too much into the ceremony, but I always like to emphasize the first part, which is when we chant the verse of atonement, we say, all evil karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, now I atone for it all. So I think this is what opens everything up. When we say evil karma, by karma we mean all of the actions that we have done physically or verbally or with our minds. And we say evil karma to refer to those actions which have had harmful consequences, produced suffering. And we talk about that in terms of our individual personal lives, but the verse you can hear is also opening things up even wider than our own personal experience or immediate individual experience. Since of old, beginningless, there's another sense of even wider proportions of time and space, so that we are really atoning for all evil karma ever committed anywhere. And we are saying that we atone for it in the sense that we are literally at one with it. So it's a ceremony in which we are acknowledging our connection to all of that evil karma. We're not turning away from it. We're not transcending it. We are acknowledging that we are part of it. We are not separate from it. We're one with it as we chant, as we bow, as we are. So it's also an action of taking responsibility. We take responsibility for all of that evil karma. Nancy Mujo Baker, in her recent book on the precepts, talks about taking responsibility when she discusses the seventh precept of not elevating oneself and blaming others or demeaning others. And she talks about taking responsibility in terms of a American philosopher whose work I didn't know, by the name of Herbert Fingeret. And she says that what Fingeret had to say is that if we want to develop as human beings, we cannot get stuck on a narrative of victimization in our life, that we can't just reduce ourselves to being victims. And to go beyond that, we also have to go beyond our tendency to attach to a view of blame, that we cannot give away, in a way, alienate our own responsibility by saying that other people or other things are ultimately responsible or to blame for our life and our situation. And connected with that, likewise, we cannot attach to a view that of guilt, that we can't get stuck in just a blame guilt situation. That's not also the perspective of atonement. And then finally, he says the most mature approach for really engaging our lives is to be responsible ourselves for all of it. So she describes this as an existential approach to our lives and to our world. And it reminds me also of Nietzsche's idea of eternal recurrence. You remember that? The idea is, if you were asked, would you be willing to live your life over again and again and again forever? Would you be willing to do that? With all of it, all of the good and all of the bad and all the ugly, with all of the pain and all of the pleasure and all of the thrills and all of the boredom and all of the suffering and all of the fulfillment. Would you be willing to do that? That's a big challenge. What do you think? But these are ideas of, I think, taking responsibility. They are kind of abstract, they're philosophical. And if we want to bring it in, approach it from a different angle, maybe we have to turn from the philosophers to the poets. I think in poetry, we can find, you know, when we talk about taking responsibility in those terms, it sounds awfully onerous. It's like a huge burden that we have to bear on our shoulders. But the poets may help us to think about it a little more freely, even a little more playfully. So I wanted to share a poem. This is by the U.S. Poet Sharon Olds. And she's sort of playing off that expression we have, like, I didn't ask for that. I didn't get what I asked for. Her poem is called, I Cannot Say I Did Not. I cannot say I did not ask to be born. I asked with my mother's beauty and her money. I asked with my father's desire for his orgasms and for my mother's money. I asked with the cradle my sister had grown out of. I asked with my mother's longing for a son. I asked with patriarchy. I asked with the milk that would well in her breasts, needing to be drained by a little living pump. I asked with my sister's hand-me-downs, lying folded. I asked with geometry, with origami, with swimming, with sewing, with what my mind would thirst to learn. Before I existed, I asked with the love of my children to exist and with the love of their children. Did I ask with my tiny flat lungs for a long portion of breaths? Did I ask with the space in the ground like a portion of breath where my body will rest when it is motionless, when its elements move back into the earth? I asked with everything I did not have to be born. And nowhere in any of it was there meaning. There was only the asking for being and then the being, the turn taken. I want to say that love is the meaning, but I think that love may be the means, what we ask with. So it seems to me that this is a remarkable way of expressing affirmation of one's life, including all of it and leaving nothing out. It's a way of an expression of will to be responsible for one's life. It's avowing one's life rather than turning away from the stuff we don't like and disavowing the things that are painful. And all of the concrete details the philosophers don't get into, there the compassion really comes through. So, but there are so many difficult and challenging things in our individual lives and going on in the world right now. And I've been very moved talking to different people in the Sangha about what they've been going through. I woke up this morning to the news about the mass shootings in Maine, where I have a family, where I'm planning to go visit over Thanksgiving. But there's the Middle East, there's Ukraine, there's so many other conflicts that I don't need to enumerate around the world. But very touched to hear from people in the Sangha about, particularly about the conflict in Gaza, Israel, the Middle East. And people expressing, you know, just the simple fact that they don't even know what to say. Or the sorrow and grief that they are experiencing. And the anger. And I don't have family there, and yet I feel some piece of that myself. What I was hearing from them was not a state of shock and of being shut down. It was different. It was like their hearts were very open and very raw. It reminded me after September 11th of 2001, I felt something like that, and a lot of other people I talked to did as well. It seemed like our hearts were broken open and very raw. And that lasted for quite a long time until the generals and the politicians got into the act and launched the war in Afghanistan. And I remember people saying, even people very different political views from my own, saying, I hope to God they don't start bombing Afghanistan, because I would never want for something like this to happen to anybody. So I was reminded of a story from the life of the Buddha. Some of you may know it, but once upon a time, there was a king who lived near the Shakya kingdom, which is, the Buddha was part of the Shakya clan. And next to the Shakya territory, there was a new king by the name of Vidudaba. And Vidudaba had been deceived by the Shakya clan, and his honor had been stained by that, by the trick that was played on him, and he was furious. And he decided, once he became king, that he was going to avenge himself. And so he assembled a huge army that was very powerful, and they marched towards Shakya territory. The Shakyas were not a militaristic people. There was no way they were going to be able to defend themselves. And the Buddha went to the border between the two countries and sat down under a tree and waited for Vidudaba to arrive. And he sat under a tree that had no leaves. And it's such a powerful image to me. It seems to, it's a universal image, but it feels so right for our times as well. A tree that has been completely dried up. It was an extremely hot day as well. And he's there under this tree that provides no shade. The tree had dried up in the drought, you can imagine. And catastrophe is looming. And the Buddha sat there under the tree and waited. And what do you think was going through his mind or through his heart? I don't think that he was in seventh heaven just blissing out. I suspect that he was very aware of that life and death was on right on the edge there, and grieving the possible slaughter and destruction that was imminent, and perhaps angry at the deeds that had been committed that had led to this situation. I imagine the Buddha sitting there with his heart very raw. And when Vidudava's army arrived at the border, he saw the Buddha sitting there. He knew the Buddha, and he respected the Buddha. The Buddha had actually been very gracious toward his family and treated them with great respect. And so he saw the Buddha, and he said to him, "And why are you sitting there under that tree that provides no shade? Why don't you come over to this side and sit under the banyan tree, the lush banyan tree, and have some shelter?" And the Buddha just responded, "I feel cooled and refreshed being in the land of my people. I feel cooled and refreshed by having my kinsmen, my people, near to me." And that's all he said. And Vidudava heard him and understood his words. He connected with the Buddha completely in that moment, and his desire to kill and to cause this great havoc completely evaporated. And he turned his back and he went back to the capital. Back in the capital, the generals and the politicians started talking to him, and they worked him up into a new furor. And once again, furious, he marched towards the border. And when he got to the border, he saw the Buddha sitting there under the tree under the sun, just out of love for his people and his land. And he turned around and he went back to the capital. And this happened a third time. And then once again, they worked him up into a state of fury, and he marched back. And this time, the Buddha knew that there was no way he could stop him. He also knew that his people had done Vidudava wrong. They had made their mistakes, and there was no preventing the catastrophe that was going to happen, the Holocaust that was going to happen, and the genocide that was going to happen. And that's what ensued. So it's a sobering story. It's a heartbreaking story. And it shows both the possibility for communication and compassion and change, as well as the limits to that among human beings. So the Buddha had faced with this terrible situation. The Buddha went straight to the border, to the point of where these two peoples and their lands met. And he engaged with the king, Vidudava. He engaged with him with his heart open, and they were able to communicate. Shakyamuni was not hiding his kinship and his affinities. He was completely open about them, and yet he spoke to Vidudava from a deeper perspective of their common humanity, and the desire that all people have to live freely and to not suffer. And so if we come back to the precept of not elevating oneself and blaming others, you can see the Buddha here sitting under that tree as embodying the seventh precept of not separating between oneself and others. And speaking to Vidudava, not separating from Vidudava. he didn't give him a lecture on what's right and what's wrong and who did the right thing and what the historical circumstances were. He just spoke to him very directly from a fundamental human standpoint. He was living and expressing the precept of not elevating oneself and blaming others. So I'd like to just come back to a couple of points. The first is for us to look at the possibility of our taking responsibility for everything that's going on beyond any kind of narrative of victimization, blame, and guilt, for taking responsibility for our lives completely and fundamentally. And second of all, the possibility of approaching any situation, no matter how difficult it may be, with our hearts open, even in the midst of grief. And from that openness of mind and heart, to be able to engage with people, not from some reflexive reaction, emotional reaction, or ideological stance, but just from a fundamental human position in a given situation of great difficulty. Can we do this? Can each of us do that? And last of all, to go back to the poets, I thought I'd read you a poem that, let me say one other thing about that precept of not elevating oneself and demeaning others. Bodhidharma says, in the realm of the equitable Dharma, not dwelling upon I against you, is called the precept of not praising yourself while abusing others. And then Dogen gives us a definition of this precept, which to me is very beautiful. And I think really it's as if he wrote it thinking about the story of the Buddha and the Shakya clan in Vidudhava. He said, Buddhas and ancestral teachers realize the empty sky and the great earth. When they manifest the noble body, there is neither inside nor outside in emptiness. When they manifest the Dharma body, there's not even a bit of earth on the ground. The Buddha manifested the noble body sitting there and speaking to Vidudhava. And we can do the same thing tonight in our bowing and chanting and in our daily lives, though it may be difficult. But to go back to the poets, this is a poem that seems to me to capture the spirit of possibility of transformation, the possibility for waking up and for living with compassion in spite of great difficulty. So this is by the South Asian poet Faiz Ahmed Faiz. It was written during the India-Pakistan War of 1965. It's called Blackout. Ever since the lights failed, I've been searching to see how I could see. Where have my eyes strayed in the dust? You who know, give me proof. Describe me to myself. A bitter river rages in my veins, and my heart, still longing for you, flows on its poisonous waves. Wait a little. Perhaps from some other world, the hand of a prophet, carved in lightning, is bringing me pearls for my lost eyes. Wait till the river is stilled, and my submerged heart, annulled like a Sufi's, is washed up, cleansed on a welcoming shore. I will then begin a new translation of hope. I will complete the texts of love. Thank you.